Michael McCusker. It is quite possible that a would-be and instantly dead assassin has cemented the presidency for Donald Trump. His fusillade of rifle shots that killed somebody else most likely annihilated the candidacy of current President Joseph Biden. The Democrats of necessity must present another opponent than just plain Joe, decent man as he appears to be, if they hope to maintain their lease on the White House. And, perhaps contrarily, this gruesome episode might just open the White House gates to a woman, finally, after nearly 2.5 centuries of America the Beautiful. It is difficult to understand why any American of intelligence and respect for honesty and credibility would vote for such an outrageous fraud as Donald Trump. The old proverb about willful dishonesty comes to mind about the ability to fool some of the people all of the time, but the general impossibility of fooling all of the people all of the time. Republican speakers at the current GOP convention are nearly unanimously blatant at blaming the attempted assassination of Trump on the Democratic Party in toto, as though the USA is once more again at civil war. The failed assassination of Trump nearly echoes the failed attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler 80 years ago this month, on July 20th, 1944, which exacted grievous revenge by hanging nearly every suspected critic of Hitler on hooks nailed to walls. The major coincidence in both attempts at assassination is their failure. The nation awaits the retribution that might occur this time if indeed Trump is once again president. Donald Trump's most troubling aspect is not his rank and blatant dishonesty or his valid reputation as an obnoxious bully. It's his Napoleonic conceit that he is humanity's master of the universe. Ironic that his would-be assassin was named Crooks. And now, I would like to read something by Ron Cronin, Rape of the Bivalves, which he wrote for the North Coast Times-Eagle. There were some good low tides last weekend, so Maria and I went up to the Neatarts Oceanside area to visit some old and good friends in the mudflat and rocky shore tidelands. We used to live in Neatarts, and in those days made regular forays to observe all the fascinating and beautiful creatures and plants exposed at low tides. This time we had quite a shock and almost committed mayhem up at Short Beach. Our first stop was to be the mudflats at Neatarts Bay, but we were outraged by what we saw there. There were literally hundreds of tourists digging up the clam beds, standing shoulder to shoulder, and flailing the fragile mudflats with their shovels and rakes. I have never seen so many people on the clam beds before, and the destruction they caused was appalling. The beaches there were nothing but holes and piles and rocks and mud. The animals that escaped being dug up were covered over by the piles dug out of the holes, and few of the diggers had the decency to fill their holes back in. I was reminded of ground hit by concentrated mortar barrages. We checked the cars lined up along the road along the bay, and almost all of them were from outside of the North Coast, Beaverton, Portland, Salem, Eugene, California, almost all tourists. It seems to me that one of our best food resources is being destroyed, with most of the destruction at the hands of outsiders in the name of fun and recreation. It is common knowledge that most of the clams dug on the coast by tourists wind up in garbage cans at the parks and along the highways. I have seen garbage cans full and reeking with rotting clams and crabs, wasted by tourists who dug them for fun and didn't know the first thing about their use or didn't like to eat them in the first place. Clam populations will not be able to keep up with such pressure and may virtually disappear from the most popular clam beds. Local people who love clams or depend on them as a food source will be forced to go without. And when we first lived in Neatarts, we were obliged by finances to eat shellfish as a major source of protein. If we had to do that now, we would starve, for only at the lowest tides of the year can you find clams in any numbers. What are the reasons for such heavy tourist pressure on our clam beds, rivers, and bays? The main one is local businessmen and chamber of commerce types have advertised these resources around the Northwest to the extent of publishing maps of clam beds and fishing spots. This has resulted in killing pressure on our fisheries resources, leaving local residents in the lurch. I don't see why we should lose our heritage so local businessmen can make a few dimes selling soda and beer. A few dimes is all, too, because most tourists bring their own food. After the scary shock at Neatarts, we went up to some rocky headlands to the north and were treated to an appalling show of total disregard for nature by three sports fishermen. At first, I thought they were biologists, seeing their close scrutiny of the mussel beds. So I walked over, hoping to talk about marine biology, and saw that they were not observing anything but smashing at the mussels with a claw hammer and shovel to find a few mussel worms for bait. The total area they destroyed easily amounts to more than 20 square feet, probably 1,000 or more mussels. Bag limit for food harvest is 72. The really scary part is they obviously do the same thing every time they go fishing. Who can know how much area these same goons have destroyed? Their destruction did not end with their leaving. For now, that huge holes have been smashed in the mussel communities. Starfish may easily invade from the side and destroy thousands of more mussels with a residual loss of habitat for the other creatures which live among the mussels. I have talked before about consideration for and love of nature, how when walking among fragile organisms, one would wear soft-soled footwear and take the greatest care to do no harm. This obvious disregard for nature we observed, this lack of consideration that all organisms have a right and a need to live, made my heart bad and my anger rage. All I can do is hope that those three and others like them will have second thoughts about their attitudes and strive to live in harmony with nature. I believe we should all constantly appraise our attitudes and actions, finding where our behavior is contrary and detrimental to nature, and learning how we may live with our environment, not against it. Once a person realizes that all of nature is wondrous and beautiful and learns to love his fellow creatures, proper attitudes and practices will result. All that is necessary for this realization is for us to open our eyes and take a good look around. That was Rape of the Bivalves by Ron Cronin. And he wrote a regular column he called Cronin's Creek for the original North Coast Times Eagle, which quite aptly was its most popular feature. Rape of the Bivalves appeared in the January 11th, 1974 issue of my version of A North Coast Times Eagle. And it is still incredibly relevant at the present time. And now, Bloody Thursday. The Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike. 90 years ago this summer, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in this country. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934, when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were often called, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime unions, and through unanimous action closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Portland, Astoria, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought bitter, pitched battles with guns, gas, and clubs arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of ship owners, presidents of stevedore companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 71st anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4th holiday provided a truce, and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off, and police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot to death by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered pistol wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. At 8 a.m. promptly, he wrote, the police went into action. Tear gas bombs were hurled into the picket lines, and the police charged with their clubs. Gasping and choking, the strikers were driven back to the alleys of the Embarcadero or retreated up Rincon Hill. Shots rang out as police opened fire with revolvers. Flying bricks and bullets crashed windows. Tear gas sent workers in nearby factory and office buildings swarming into the streets. The whole area was swept by a surf of fighting men. Police cars literally filled the headquarters with gas from long-range guns, and persons entrenched there poured from the doors. Quinn wrote that workers on the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, then under construction, were forced to abandon the job for the day because of stray bullets whistling around their heads. Police charged into the Seaboard Hotel, Quinn continued, where many strikers were quartered, and drove all occupants into the streets, swinging their long riot sticks and cracking skulls right and left. The building was filled with gas and riddled with pistol fire. Continuing from Quinn's book, The Big Strike, stubbornly holding their ground and fighting every inch of the way, the strikers were driven back into the city and off the Embarcadero. The battle swept over into the busy downtown district, endangering crowds of pedestrians. One picket, striker, entrenched himself in a parking lot, devised a crude slingshot from an old inner tube, and began bombarding Chief of Police William J. Quinn's, no relation to Ryder Quinn, car with bricks. It took a barrage of tear gas and pistol fire to dislodge him. A badly wounded man lying on the pavement cursed the police and refused to allow them to remove him. Later, he was taken to a hospital in a private car. Scores of men littered the sidewalks, either lying silently or crawling away painfully on their hands and knees. A woman alighting from a streetcar at the ferry building screamed and collapsed when a bullet struck her in the temple. A man rushed to her assistance, was struck by another bullet, and crumpled to the street beside her. A Chronicle reporter described women who had been shopping in downtown stores arrived at the Loop to step into an inferno. With screaming children clinging to them, they disembarked from the cars to find themselves in clouds of smarting tear gas. Guns cracked. Men fell screaming as they went down. Police clubs cracked against skulls, smothered and blinded by gas. The women and children staggered about helplessly. Policemen grabbed them as fast as possible and sent them to a hospital, where they were horrified by the sight of men dripping with blood, moaning from bullet wounds and injuries. People in surrounding buildings were driven out by gas, and many were winged by stray shots as they fled. At the height of the battle, a delegation from the strike committee, headed by Harry Bridges, called on Mayor Angelo J. Rossi to protest. The mayor simply repeated what acting California Governor Frank Merriman had said earlier: "You refuse to arbitrate, now take the consequences." Hospitals were put on a wartime basis to accommodate the wounded. At the morgue, covered over by white sheets, were two cold, quiet bodies, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. Quinn quoted a newspaper: "The hottest battle took place in front of the ILA, International Longshoremen's Association, now the ILWU, International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, on Stewart Street, where scores were gassed, clubbed, and shot. The striking union men had detailed to the hospitals to see that wounded pickets received adequate attention when brought in from the battlefield. These men reported later that injured strikers were threatened and intimidated by police when they stated that their club and gunshot wounds were caused by officers. At the close of the day, Acting Governor Merriam ordered the National Guard onto the waterfront. 2,000 troops marched into the area equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles. By the time they arrived, the fighting had ceased and the pickets had been driven from the Embarcadero. The guardsmen posted themselves at intervals down the whole length of the waterfront and mounted machine guns on the roofs of piers. Troops marched in wearing steel helmets and full-service equipment. They set up camp inside the long, covered docks, established field kitchens, and remained there under wartime conditions. Divisions were brought in from Santa Rosa, Napa, Petaluma, Gilroy, and other outlying towns. Rumors were abundant to the effect that certain units had refused service, but strict censorship was maintained and definite confirmations were lacking. All day long, newspapers uptown had been pouring out extra after extra, delivering veritable hourly reports from the line of battle. Wailing sirens careening up and down Market Street aroused speculation and alarm among the police. The word "blood, blood, blood" recurred every three or four lines in every news story. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily, as they typed their copy. Reporters had been in the thick of the fighting all day long. Many had bruised limbs and minor injuries to help them remember. These hurts soon healed and passed away, but an experience, a reality, was impressed in their minds that would never wear away and would affect their ideas, their decisions, and their loyalties for the rest of their lives. The strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. And that was all by Mike Quinn. On Monday, July 9, 1934, a funeral march was held for Howard Sperry and Nicholas Boudoir. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast, the length of Market Street, behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A union band played a funeral march by Beethoven. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava. Solemn strains of dirges and hymns, uncountable thousands of spectators lining the streets with uncovered heads. Overhead, a brilliant sun in a cloudless sky. Another newspaper said that the two dead strikers in life would not have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. For all practical purposes, Mike Quinn wrote, not a wheel moved or a lever budged. The official reaction was hysteria. The general strike was confused with revolution. Rumors in newspapers claimed that a communist army was marching on the city from the north. Northwesterners were thought to be communists and radicals because of strong IWW activity the preceding decade. 500 extra policemen were hired, and thousands more National Guardsmen were sent to San Francisco from all over California. Police red squads raided strikers' homes and union offices. Vigilantes attacked and beat striking workers that they accused of being communists. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934, and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition. Contracts were signed and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers from employment. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. Instead, there ensued a period of industrial guerrilla warfare, which persisted more than 2 years, ultimately resulting in the whole Pacific Coast maritime strike breaking out again in greater force than ever, the Great Maritime Strike of 1936. The Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the United States. It heralded the vast organizing drives that gave birth to the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, which later became affiliated with the American Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. And it set an example of militant solidarity that proved beneficial to other unions in the great labor struggles of the 1930s. The 1934 strike is memorable because, above all, it demonstrated the power latent in the rank and file, Harry Bridges said a few years later. The rank and file not only manned the picket lines and did the sacrificing, as it must in every strike, but it also made the big decisions and determined the strategy. The rank and file would not be bulldozed or buffaloed browbeaten or divided, and therefore it could not be licked. Once it knew the score, the rank and file could not be misled by any phony labor leader or panicked by any barrage of newspaper propaganda. Bridges said that, ultimately, the power of any union that serves as an instrumentality of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is one fundamental truth that has not altered since 1934, nor will it alter in times to come. We have had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Bridges said, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again by the thousands up Market Street in honor of the two dead strikers. One ship owner bitterly complained that on every July 5th there is a complete cessation of work up and down the whole Pacific coast because of a holiday declared by the unions for the purpose of commemorating a day of violence and bloodshed. No one authorizes the July 5th holiday excepting a 100% accord of the entire maritime profession, Mike Quinn wrote in The Big Strike, which was first published in 1949, 13 years after he wrote it, and 2 years after his death at age 41. Therefore, it is regarded as a completely unauthorized stoppage of work and an illegal act, Quinn wrote. The maritime unions have nothing by which to defend this annual disregard for authority other than an old, almost forgotten phrase in the yellow documents of the Revolution of 1776, which reads, "By the consent of the governed." And that was written there by Mike Quinn, and is something I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, Bloody Thursday, the Great Pacific Coast Maritime Strike. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris is engineer for this program. So now the USA seems momentarily encompassed by the GOP's Project 2025. You might accurately label it Mein Trump, after a similar political platform trumpeted by the aforementioned Adolf Hitler, who was at the time in jail for his fascist behavior. And today, in 1925, Hitler's Mein Kampf was published, which was written while he was in jail, and which outlined his plan for world domination and eradication of Jewry and other lesser peoples, which most likely included about two-thirds to possibly three-quarters of the world's human population. Certainly, Nelson Mandela, who was born today in 1918. And on today's date, in 64 AD, the Great Fire of Rome erupted, which lasted a week and destroyed nearly two-thirds of the city.